and welcome to another episode of Not Quite Great Books, a TV podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Danielle Hanley, and joining me on the other line, I'm not sure that he could make it through 6 silent minutes at the top of this episode. It's John McMahon. Now he's out of spite, is just not talking.
Spite is the only way that I could make it. But the listeners know I have lots of takes. I have lots of nonsense to say. I love to talk about shit, including and especially the Americans, but really anything.
I was just like, I couldn't be quiet for that long. I couldn't do it.
I'm like barely quiet that long enough when it's just me in the apartment. Like, I'm talking to the cat. I'm muttering to myself. I'm like commenting on like the thing that I am doing or reading or cooking or whatever. I am not capable of shutting up for 6 minutes, but the Americans is.
Oh, same. I mean, I'm fully talking to myself. I'm also singing songs to myself. My little sister, true, Becky, makes up songs about everything. One great song that she has made up that we have all adopted is eggs, 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 eggs.
Yeah.
And like, great, it goes, there are a lot of verses to it.
I don't know how there can be a lot of verses to it, but I'm intrigued. Does Becky want to compose a theme song for Not Quite Great Books?
I'd ask her. Yeah. Okay. It'll probably involve eggs.
we can play it over the end credits instead of the beginning.
She's definitely
we
the
love
sister.
Our electro trends 60s from Less FM.
She's definitely the sister that knows the least about the Americans, so it will have nothing to do with the Americans as a as a show.
TBT, even though I think it's Friday, to that time when all this, the Hanleys were on the pod.
Sororal conspiracy, I believe.
Sororal conspiracy, that. Great, great poll.
Listen, Bonnie Honig is always on my brain. Oh, my God. John, what are we here to do?
Great question. I think we'll talk about the Americans some and probably have a lot of digressions. And when we're talking about the Americans, it'll be the Americans season 4, episode 8. This is a long one, Danielle. The oof, magic of David Copperfield 5, colon, the Statue of Liberty disappears, which is directed by Matthew Reese. First time directing, and yeah, written by Stephen Schiff. Danielle, what's our summary for this episode?
The IMDb summary for this episode is, the Jennings approach their breaking points as both Philip and Elizabeth must handle loyal agents. Will they make it through with their patriotism and sanity intact?
For one of my favorite episodes of The Americans, that is one of the worst summaries that exists.
Terribly terrible. Like, so terrible. There are so many ways to summarize this episode that don't give away spoilers. And, like, this is the blandest way you could possibly do it.
Look, we're constantly, like, bullshitting on what the theme is for the main discussion. And, like, we came up with, like, 4 in 3 minutes earlier this evening. And professionals writing headlines for IMDb could not do it.
Do we think these are professionals? Question.
did ChatGPT write this?
I mean, would ChatGPT have done a better job? Maybe.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like, you feed them the script and give them the directions to not spoil key plot points, and, like, they would do a better job than this. It would do a better job than this. I think it, that's one of the pushes, right, is to not refer, not use, like, human pronouns for it.
I feel like we are wading into territory that I do not want to be in, so let's get to the
same
main discussion.
This is winter
pronouns
break.
Pronouns for ChatGPT, like, not interested.
Yeah,
not interested.
We're on winter break. The audience will be hearing this. We'll be, like, deep, deep into the spring semester, but that's okay.
I mean, I feel like I'll be almost done because I think I start roughly a month before you.
Yeah, more or less.
Listen, we're on winter break. We're recording on a Friday evening. It's already 7:30. We've just started recording. So, like, buckle up, everyone. You've already experienced roughly 3 digressions. We promise there will be more.
I'm just going to keep going with the digressions.
Great.
I think we need Kellercino to, like, lay down some lines about, like, over-unders on digressions in an episode of Not Quite Great Books, where we should task him with that for the finale.
Yeah.
But, like, he has to, like, do it for future episodes or something, because we can't have him establishing the line on the episode he's in.
Because he's also a digression king.
No fucking kidding.
I think in 413, we ask him the over-under on digressions for all the episodes in season 5.
All of them? Like an average? Or
no, and like then, per episode.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. Okay, per episode.
Yeah. And we see how he does. And in 513, we evaluate.
By evaluate, you mean make John keep track of this and listen to all of the episodes, correct?
Well, yes, and also, like, pay
us in ChatGPT evaluate this?
Pay us in cannolis.
That's the only form of payment that I accept from the Kellercino.
Amazing. All right. We're pressing on. We, as consummate professionals, as you are all well aware of, we have decided to organize this episode around the concept of consolidation, because it seems like one of the things that's happening across many of the different interactions and scenes in this episode is a kind of consolidation, a kind of coming together. And I think, like, for me, this really crystallized with regard to Philip. And I think we're watching a process of what I called to John in the most obnoxious political theory way possible. Becoming Philip.
Metal. Yeah.
Yeah. We do not fuck around here. And so
it's funny because that's the only thing that
we do. It's the only thing we do. This whole podcast is literally predicated on us fucking around.
No ambition, just vibes. I.e. just fucking around.
It's like all affect all the time. Did I tell you this, that my students, I was, like, trying to describe what affect was to my students, and they were like, so it's vibes? And I was like, you are?
Close enough.
Not wrong.
Yeah.
I will take it. Okay. Becoming Philip. So I think, for me, this starts with, and sort of fitting that it starts with the beginning of the episode, it starts in that, like, long, silent stretch where there is... I think we are watching Philip realize in real time, more so than he had, right? We're watching Philip realize that this is really the end of Clark. This is the end of this other, like, on my read, quite formative relationship in his life. And that the loss of Clark requires prompts a kind of coming together that I don't think he's quite comfortable with.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot to say just about how wonderful the scene is, and we'll get there. But to respond to that point in particular, thinking about this scene after rewatching the episode last night, I think the thing that really struck me is how much this scene, at least, if you could possibly isolate it, you can't, but if you could possibly isolate it from the structure of a spy show and mm-hmm. a spy and his agent, like, it is actually a breakup scene, right? Like, yeah. It's a romantic relationship breakup scene in a drama that's like an emotional drama or soap opera or like whatever it is that's separate from the spy thing. And I say that because, like, the way the episode actually opens is maintenance of a daily routine in the state of, like, a pure emergency or something like that. Like, we have them lying in bed, but then we have Martha brushing her teeth as if it's normal, putting her makeup on as if it's normal. Like, they're all having peanut butter or butter on toast as if it's a normal breakfast. Wordlessly, of course. But there's, like, a way in which the episode starts off by grounding us in the, like, daily maintenance of, like, a relationship or of a life or whatever in this state of crisis. So, like, the breakup scene, the kiss, the I'll never see you again, the, like, all of the don't be alone, but I'll actually, we'll both be alone. Like, all of these are classic tropes of, like, a breakup scene in a drama.
Yeah.
So the fact that the show was able to incorporate those so seamlessly into what this show is, and B, do so in such a stylistically, like, superb and, like, profound way, was just a major accomplishment.
No, I fully agree with that. The one place I would, like, maybe add even more nuance to what you offered. And I love thinking about it as a breakup scene because you're absolutely right. And it, like, it raises the question of how does one lose? How does one, like, survive after the loss of someone, right? Like, how does one keep going, right? Yeah. That's always my question. The place for, I think, some nuance is that also within all of those scenes, and, like, one way to think about it, right, is, like, crisis ordinary, to, like, pull from Berlant a little bit.
Yep.
But within all of those scenes, there's always a, like, a tiny tick, like, against the ordinary. There's Martha turning over. There's Martha, like, staring at the peanut butter and likely contemplating, am I ever going to have peanut butter ever again, right?
Exactly. Like, yeah.
Right. There is the, like, pulling up to, there's the silent car ride, but there's Gabriel in the back. Like, there's all these, like, little pieces that are reminding us that that amidst all of this ordinary is also the, like, totally extraordinary and the other way around too.
It's an excellent point, and I think kind of it highlights that extraordinary nature of it, and it highlights the way in which those conventional tropes or narratives or storylines or trajectories or whatever are actually impossible in the universe of the Americans, right? There can be nothing else. Like, jury's out / no comment on Elizabeth and Philip, but, like, outside of the possibility of Elizabeth and Philip, there can be nothing else but a fucked up tragic love story, like, that exists in the University of the Americans. Witness the many fucked up tragic love stories we have seen thus far, like, particularly circling around Nina. So, like, there's that aspect of it. And, like, to push your point even further, they are going on this car ride with Gabriel in the back with a dead rat with a, like, biological weapon contained inside of it to some secret cornfield airstrip.
Wild.
To, like, go on a secret fucking flight to Cuba. Like, it's the structure of the world, and, like, there's a way which Claudia actually encapsulates all of this so brilliantly in her and Gabriel scene, where, like, Claudia is like, the world is mad. The world is, like, what prevents any of human relationships or human attempts to exert planning, control, and direction. Like, that's what frustrates those, is that the world is fucked up. And so the way that the show is able to both and the breakup love story, tragic love story, and the fucked upness of the world in which that is unfolding is really excellent, especially because they do it without any words.
Well, and that's
six,
like,
6 minutes, 5 minutes.
Right. And that's, like, the amazing thing about this scene is that there's so much communicated with no words. And also, it's like the consolidation piece of this, to come back to that, is like so clear, right? Because all of these, like, pokes out of the ordinary are part of the consolidating of Philip, which I think is a process that, like, we see start in the episode prior when he tells Martha that he can't go with her, right? And he tells Elizabeth that he's not going with her. This is him making a choice to continue being a spy here, right? And, like, this is the first time that we have seen him really be able to, like, where someone else has offered him that choice. Right?
Yeah, including Elizabeth in the prior episode.
Yeah. And so I think, like, watching this opening scene and watching the sort of loss of Martha as not just the loss of Martha, but the consolidation of a version of Philip who actually really needed the outlet of Clark. He needed the outlet of, like, this quote-unquote normal relationship, this quote-unquote, like, this, like, the alternative to the life that he has, right, is the life with
Martha. A question for you, though. Did he need Clark? I know how you're going to answer. Did he need Clark or did he need Martha?
I think it's both, right?
I'm in a rare singularity moment. Cool. I'm going to go with, like, he needs Martha more than he needs Clark. Because, like, I think the story of Clark and Martha is the story of the shedding of Clark to become Philip with Martha.
Oh, interesting, because I would argue that, like, he's never fully Philip with, like, he's never only Philip with Martha. Like, that there's some conglomerate of, like, Philip and Clark that is the person he is with Martha. So I think that, but I think that, I guess the way that I want to read all of the, like, S stuff and the work that Philip is sort of doing on himself, which is infuriating to everyone around him, right? Like, in this episode and in other episodes. And, like, it's confusing to Elizabeth, and here we see it come to a head. But I would say that that stuff, to me, is, like, a searching for himself in a way that I think illustrates, at least to me, that, like, Clark is a part of him. Maybe Clark only exists in relation to Martha, right? Like, so that, not to fully push back against your point, but, like, I think that the Clark of it all is actually incredibly important.
Okay. Yeah. No, I can certainly see that. I'm very focused on the Martha in these 5, 6, 7 minutes of the cold open, because like, I'm thinking about the way that Philip's body is positioned in space in these scenes once he and Martha are pulled apart. And, like, there's the scene as Martha, the camera shot as Martha boards the plane, where, like, there's an emphasis on Philip, like, slightly off center, but, like, he is empty and small and alone.
Yeah.
And then even more so, they, like, further extrapolate that kind of camera work when the plane is taking off, in which we have, like, Philip is in the foreground. Matthew Rhys is in the foreground of the shot, but he's made to be so small by the surroundings and by the plane moving in the opposite direction, so that all we see are, like, it's, like, wing lights, that it's constantly emphasizing the lack of presence that Martha's departure causes for, and I think Philip rather than Clark in that moment. So, like, there's something about the camera work that's happening there. That's part of why I may be a little overemphasizing Martha more so than I would in other places. And the other reason why I think I'm emphasizing Martha a little bit more is both, like, the lines that Alison Wright delivers and the way she delivers them, and also the way that Alison Wright uses her body to act in space in these final scenes. So for the lines, it's her, "Don't be alone, Clark," which is, like, oh, fuck. Like, that's the gut punch that Elizabeth gave to Martha in the previous episode, emotionally to Philip right there, including calling him Clark, to your point.
That was sort of where my brain was, but keep going.
Yeah. So there's that, which is just gutting in general and gutting in the way that Alison Wright delivers it. And then Philip, like, kind of anodynely gives it back to her, the "don't be alone," and she just kind of laughs it off, like, oh, sure, yeah, okay, fine, whatever. And then they kiss, right? And then there's Martha's stare from the inside of the plane back at Philip, and it's the way that Alison Wright is acting that with the way it gets blocked, because it's like the camera cannot handle Martha's stare in that moment. Like, the where the first cut happens from Martha's stare, like, it's as if the camera can't handle it. And then the plane has wheeled around, and now Martha is looking out the other fucking side. Still at Clark/Philip, and I'm like, oh my god. And it's just, like, a beautifully done scene.
No, I mean, like, no notes.
Apologies for the extremely long soliloquy on the, like, on how that scene was created.
No notes.
Matthew Rhys, no less. Like, I believe this is his first time directing, too, which is just bonkers to me.
It's such a good scene, and I was, like, I was paying attention to these pieces of it, and also the fact that there's no music. It's just, like, you're just hearing the sounds of their interactions.
And the wind.
Yeah.
They, like, amp up the sound design of the wind in the mix in really cool ways.
Yeah. Oh, such a good scene. Oh.
The winds of change.
Rough. It's rough. It's rough for us. So it's like Philip realizes that there's no more Clark, or that this is the end of something. And he cries, which is also, like, I'm interested in that.
Gee, I wonder why.
You're always your dissertation. Maybe from there we think a little bit about Philip and Elizabeth, because I think this is the other place where you see consolidation, and I would say, like, consolidation in a more, not negative is not exactly the valence of consolidation. It has shifted once we get into the Philip and Elizabeth of it all. At least I think that. Does that make sense to you? That there's like a more negative or sinister, or like there's something darker at work here.
Yes. And the thing that's darker is like several layers deep. It comes in some ways from both directions.
Yeah.
Because, like, I'm thinking of, there's this scene where Philip is reading Est on the couch, and, like, he doesn't really want to talk, which is understandable, and Elizabeth, like, can't or won't, and maybe more won't, like, accept the depths to which the Martha thing has affected Philip.
I think it's won't.
Yeah. And, but which I don't quite understand. I mean, like, I guess it makes sense on a character level, but, like, you think that Elizabeth would at least be a better spy. Or maybe this is, like, the limit case of Elizabeth as spy when it runs up into, like, some other kind of inner emotional and psychic worldings. But, like, that's, I think, a point of discussion. But then the scene that I think best encapsulates that is, like, one of the cruelest scenes non-murdering people division in Elizabeth's arc, where, like, the only words she has to say about Martha are that she was simple and uncomplicated, which deeply, deeply, deeply offends Philip, and, like, deeply offends us as audience members who appreciated Martha and appreciated Alison Wright's performance as Martha. And there's a good, like, interpolation of the audience on Philip's side in that moment. Yeah. But, like, I think that's the crucial scene for if there was going to be a way in which Philip and Elizabeth could come closer over this, like, traumatic experience to Martha most of all, but in the ways you have articulated to Philip as well, like, that possibility gets foreclosed at least for 7 months in that moment, in that conversation.
It's interesting. I don't disagree with that, but I think the moment that I would add there is when Elizabeth blows up later after she goes to the Est meeting, right? Which is like when she's like, at least she got to, like, fly away to Cuba and survive, like, and didn't get, like, I forget the line read there, but it's like, wasn't butchered on the street.
Wasn't sent out to get butchered on the street.
Yeah. And so I think like the way, I think your read of the earlier scene is right, but I also wonder, so I think it's like Elizabeth can't see the Philip-Martha relationship as something more, because doing so requires her to sort of, like, tap into her own, like, traumatic experience around Gregory, which is, like, the closest thing. And I actually think in the kitchen moment, the earlier one, she's like, hasn't quite allowed herself yet to absorb just how monumental is not the word, but how, like, I don't know, like, profound this has been for Philip. And it's only later when she's so angry and some of the layers, like, she's peeled off some of the layers. Maybe as a function of Est, maybe just as a function of, like, simmering for a few hours, right? Where she's like, listen, you're not the only person who has, like, lost someone. And this is, like, not even a loss. Like, she's alive. Like, Gregory is, like, dead. So fuck you. You know, that's, like, essentially what she says to him.
Yeah. No, this is a great point. And I think it clarifies what I was attempting to say, and that, like, I think from Philip's perspective, when Elizabeth, like, can only think of Martha as simple and uncomplicated from him, like, well, then there's no possibility or capability of, like, Elizabeth understanding this.
Yeah.
And then it's Elizabeth articulating in a deep, much deeper way for the reasons you just said, why and how she's unable to do that, and more so pushing it further, but pushing it in a way that is so real for her as a character. And, like, this is why the whole thing can make sense. And I agree that, like, Elizabeth can't fully get there in that scene in the kitchen because I don't think at that point she has consciously, but presumably as a character, unconsciously she's making the Gregory connection.
Yeah.
And then it's only later when that connection can actually happen. And they can have what is, like, maybe the first or second most, like, significant and incredibly acted, like, just drag out emotional fight that they have had together so far in The Americans. I mean, the lines of, like, and now you're stuck with me. And she said, like, I chose to be stuck with you when I took you back after you slept with Irina and then lied to my face about it.
Yeah.
Like, that's a deeper cut than even their most intense fights have typically gone to in previous times.
Fully agree with that. Fully agree. And I think, like, I think what is happening in that later scene in that fight is, like, a consolidation for Elizabeth, right?
Yes.
Like that, and it is in some ways a consolidation of their relationship, right? Like, it's all of these things that have been unsaid for so long being thrown out in, like, a pretty vicious way, but in a way that, like, only the absence of Martha, like, allows for them to come out, right? Like, this is precisely what Philip is working on in Est, that, like, he can't get at these things, and it's exactly what, like, Martha was good, his relationship with Martha was good for him because it was a place where he could say all this stuff that he couldn't say in his marriage, right? We're also seeing that happen with Elizabeth, too, where it's, like, going through these motions together is, like, and all prompted by the, like, ripping away of Martha. Things that maybe needed to happen for a long time are coming to the surface, but even we see in the episode, it takes a little while for them to bubble up.
I think that the emphasis on the absence of Martha or Martha being ripped away is correct.
Yeah.
In two senses. First, that Philip finds out via Stan that he was right, and Elizabeth affirms that he was right. So that's a really crucial moment.
Yeah.
But then they have the fight anyway. Right. And, like, that's, I think, what's most important. And I think the relevant contrast is with the previous episode, the scene in the safe house where Elizabeth tells Philip, like, in a couple of years, you can go to Martha. You can go be with her. You can, like, have your escape and have your fantasy. And there's a moment of articulation of a very genuine bond and love between the two of them in that moment. And then we get, in some ways, not the polar opposite of it, but, like, other side of the same coin or some cliche such as that in the fight between them. And so that raises the question, I think, of what has, like, what can explain the difference in one day to 2 to 3 days for over 1 or 2 or 3 days later. And it's like, now Martha's just actually gone. And, like, the consolidation, to your point, is happening.
Yeah.
Because, like, at root, what is the thing that is the basis of consolidation for Philip and Elizabeth? They were chosen to be put together and are indeed stuck with one another. Like, there's a whole shit ton of stuff built on top of that. But, like, if we were to consolidate it to its most fundamental parts, like, that's the thing. And one of the, like, big questions of the entire The Americans over its many seasons is, to what extent can there be more built on top of that?
Yeah, and I think, like, what's interesting about that, right, is that Philip always wants there to be something more, and I think Elizabeth is content. Like, it strikes me that Elizabeth is most of the time content with it being, like, convenience plus. Like, it doesn't bother her. It doesn't seem to bother her in the same way that it, like, rubs at Philip's, like, soul.
As long as the plus is there, then yes.
It can't just be convenience. There has to be something else. But we see in these earlier, it's like, I think it's in season 2 where we sort of see, like, that first, where they're, like, in the motel and she's like, okay, let's start having kids. It's like that scene, right? So, like, she was reluctant earlier on, but there's something about, like, the way she conducts herself. And this, I think, is back to your earlier point about, like, us seeing the limits of Elizabeth being a spy coming into play here, right? And so I think, like, one of the things that I'm thinking about is that Philip always seems to need more emotional connection, support, like relationality than Elizabeth does. Not that she doesn't need any, but it's not as pressing for her.
Indeed. And for her, that is emblematic of Philip has become more American. She has stayed more Soviet.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And like, she is the one that like stays behind with Gabriel, and Gabriel's like, do you want to talk about it? And she's like, no, like this is, of course I don't want to talk about it.
Get out of here with your like millennial processing bullshit. Like I grew up in during the fucking war.
I'm not in Est. which is even funnier when she fucking goes to Est.
What was that like for you when we're at an S seminar and we're meant to assume that it's Philip and then camera pans to Elizabeth?
I literally said out loud, are you fucking kidding me? And it fits in the episode, but I was like, no fucking way does Elizabeth ever go to an EST meeting. I'm sorry, like, that's wild. And then it becomes clear that she goes to the EST meeting because, like, she's boiling and she wants to throw it in his face. She goes also because she wants to understand it, but she also goes because she's boiling.
I don't think she's boiling until she gets back.
Oh, I don't think the
boiling is particularly part of the motivation to go on anything more than, you might be saying this on a purely like unconscious level, but like, I think she goes there to be a good spy, to potentially try to be a good partner, and also to like, for once and for all, put an end to this bullshit. Like, I think that those are the motivations. And that last one is obviously consistent with boiling.
Well, that's, and I'm maybe thinking about boiling in a more unconscious sense. Where my brain jumped to was like the episode of The West Wing. Have you seen The West Wing?
I have not.
Oh my God. Well, we can't do a podcast on The West Wing because there's just too many fucking episodes and it gets really bad after season 4. But there is,
I think I would hate it.
Yeah, you would definitely hate it. We also can't do any more things that you don't like because that makes it very hard for me.
Okay, question after we've recorded. I know this was months ago when people hear this. Can we do things that you don't like? How is your reflecting on your experience of being the hater on Saltburn?
I think I'm just like not as good of a hater as you are. Like,
I think I'm both offended and deeply appreciative of that comment.
No, but I mean, like, like you are, and I mean this in like the best way possible, like you're passionate about the things you like and you're passionate about the things that you don't like. And sure. I'm, and I think this goes back to like, I was talking to Amy about this today, but this goes back to like where we stand in terms of like cultural artifacts, right? Which is like, I think that it's perfectly fine for there to be things out there that I don't enjoy. And like, I'm not going to not watch them. I'm not going to watch everything I don't enjoy, but I'm not going to like be angry about spending time watching Saltburn. I feel good that like I saw it and that like I understand all the jokes about it and whatever. Tori has been sending me some really funny TikToks about it.
Excellent.
And also, like, sort of don't feel anything about it. Whereas I feel like when you don't like something, it consumes you. And there are totally things that consume me. This is not saying that there aren't.
Oh, no, I take that as a compliment.
Yeah. Don't worry. But, like I...
That's my, like, my one area of being an edgelord, so...
Like, who cares that I didn't like? Like, I'm not going to try to convince you to like Loki or Moon Knight. I just accept that you don't. And, like, I might force you to keep watching it because we, like, decided to do this. Although I maintain that I
and
offered...
I had a perverse joy in doing
this
so.
This is exactly it. And that's the difference, right? Like,
yep.
I don't have a perverse joy in, like, not liking something. I'm just like, okay, well, I didn't like that. I do want to say, before we go back to the Americans, first thought I had in the first scene, especially with the plane, is like, well, this is just like the beginning of Black Widow. Where they're like in that little plane. I was like, oh, okay.
I don't remember that.
where, like, they, like, pull literally the plane that they're in and the Americans, like, out of some garage. And then there's not, it's not even, like, an airship. They're, like, on a farm somewhere. Same deal. Flying to Cuba. That's how the movie starts. Oh,
okay. Yeah, now I remember. There was, like, an attack on the little, like, house that they're in.
Yeah, like, he gets whatever thing he needs, and then they're escaping America, and then, like, they, you know, the Americans know that they're escaping America, so they, like, try come after the plane, and so...
And do I remember that they then, like, cut to a cover of Nirvana to do, like, the opening credits?
Yeah, you were mad about that. In the moment.
I have no doubt. there's zero doubt in my mind that I made a snarky or multiple snarky remarks to you in at Cumberland 12.
We love Cumberland 12.
America's greatest movie theater.
America's greatest movie theater, rivaled by another that we're going to talk about later.
Brilliant.
Okay. I think maybe we want to talk a little bit about the Elizabeth Lisa situation.
Yeah, because there's a way in which I think Elizabeth, like, Philip obviously hits a new breaking point with Martha's departure. And there's something about the situation with Lisa that's, I think, a similar new breaking point for Elizabeth, except that it's much more sudden. It's less expected on her part, on Gabriel's part, on Philip's part, and the audience's part than, like, the counterpoint breaking point for Philip. Like, that's a much more expected, anticipated, rolled out breaking. Yeah. And there's, like, something about, and it's smart of the show to pair, like, this long played in the most brilliant way, breaking, disintegration, to go back to the Lily episode, with the, like, very sudden break that Elizabeth experiences here upon, she would frame it as having to kill Lisa.
Yeah.
Because Lisa is about to go to the police. And there's several layers of tragedy to this for us as viewers.
Yeah.
And some of those also apply to Elizabeth as a character. There's the fact that, like, Lisa had been abused by her husband, right, for some period of time. And, like, her husband took all the money that was given to her for her spying.
Yeah.
And, like, left to Florida with another woman. There's the fact of she has kids, and, like, these kids now become, like, parentless question mark.
Yeah.
Then, like, for us as the viewer, there's also the fact that we have, like, a white woman murdering a black woman is, like, part of it for the more meta perspective or the more perspective of, like, us having it. I'm not sure if that's on Elizabeth's mind at all. Although, like, the fact that she had a black lover, like, who was a true love, maybe means it's on her mind. I don't know.
I think that, like, that last point is important, because I think it becomes... There's something especially tragic about her killing Lisa after this moment, right? Like, after this moment where she's unearthed the stuff about Gregory after so long, right? It's been...
Season one.
Yeah, I was about to say, like, somewhere like three seasons since we even talked about Gregory. And so, like, there's something tragic but also poetic within the universe of the show that, like, the black former lover comes up, and she's then made to murder this, like, black colleague of hers, right? But there's something happening there, even if she's not making the connection. I think it's something that we're meant to connect.
Yeah, and especially, like, the language that we use to talk about this, like, makes me think about how the appeal to structure is often used to excuse acts of violence, particularly acts of, like, racialized and gendered violence, right? It's totally accurate within the universe of the show for us to say Elizabeth was made to kill, but there's, like, a removal of the agency or a removal of the responsibility that language produces that I think is, like, symptomatic of how structural violence gets abstracted away from, like, people actually committing violence.
Yeah, it's a really important point, and I think it is, like, in the universe of a spy show, I'm, like, so much more apt to say, like, well, she was made to, right? Like, the threat is, like, present and palpable, and it's right there. And yet, like, the she was made to is also the way we talk about it when we, just like you're saying, when we sort of abstract to the structure as the sort of causal mechanism for the thing yeah. that's happening, right? So it's like functioning on two levels.
It is, and it's bringing me back to some of our season one discussions. Like, apparently this is the episode in which, like, we also go back to season one.
Time jump.
And, yes, we're time jumping backwards, though. And it's the conversations we had about how the TV show, like, uses the structures and conventions of moving images and storytelling to, like, implicate the viewer, because, like, the protagonists of the show are at root Philip and Elizabeth. Mm-hmm. Like, there are other protagonists. There's Paige, there's Martha, there's Nina, right? Like, those are all protagonists yeah. in their own way. But the central protagonists and the central, like, audience identification machinery, like, functions through Elizabeth and Philip,
yeah.
thus implicating us in the precisely what you were saying of the spy show makes us say Elizabeth was made to kill Lisa.
No, I think that is, like, spot on. Also, I haven't thought about our first season literally since our first season. So
when did we do that? That was 2 years ago.
It was like
recording wise, like.
Yeah, it was 2 years ago because we started this over winter break my first year in Worcester. Well, with that, let's move on to Philip and Gabriel.
Sure.
Okay, so coming back to this, like, this consolidation point.
Please.
So thinking
Thank you for doing that, because Lord knows I am not.
Well, it's not the smoothest of transitions, but I'm doing it anyway. So, like, the interaction we get a lot of Gabriel in this episode, right?
Yeah.
We've already talked about Gabriel in the first scene, but the place I want to take us is the scene between Philip and Gabriel in the bar, which, like, while that they're ordering tea out of teacups in a bar, but that's a whole thing.
In the middle of the day.
In the middle of the day. Like, get a whiskey. Come on. Anyway.
Yeah, they can't get vodka shots with pickles, which is the Russian way to drink in the middle of the day.
Ooh.
As I did many times when I was there.
I just hate vodka so much. Like, so much.
I have one particular memory of, so, like, my dad, like, came to visit me Russia while I was studying there. And, like, I had him over for dinner, like, at my host family. My host family had him over for dinner where, like, I had to be the translator, which was a cool experience. And so, like, the day my dad, like, departs, like, I get him in a cab to the airport.
Yeah.
I get back to my host family, and it's, like, my host dad has the day off, and it's, like, fucking 10:30 in the morning, and he's, like, so that your father, like, has safe travels, we have to do shots. And so I did vodka shots and ate pickles with my host father at 10:30 in the morning for, like, safe travels for my, like, bio father.
Listen, I do want to say, I'm sure I've talked about this on this podcast before, but, like, I love a pickle back, right?
Sure.
Shot of whiskey, shot of pickle juice, and done. I love Abe Fisher, which is a restaurant in Philly, has a dirty martini, but it's with pickle juice instead of olive juice. Amazing.
I would like that. I'd be into that.
Every time I go, that's, like, what Joel and I do. We, like, go to Abe Fisher and get they're called Abe Fisher's. I was in the liquor store, like, a couple of weeks ago buying a bottle of wine, and just seeing, like, seltzer that has vodka in it, like, made my stomach feel gross. I hate vodka so much. Philip and Gabriel, they're not drinking vodka. They're drinking tea, or they're at least drinking out of teacups.
Sure.
But I think, like, to come back to this.
Hot toddy hours?
Oh, maybe. Although there's no tea bag. I want to think a little bit about Philip insisting upon telling Martha's parents, and Gabriel being yeah. like, there is a procedure, and, like, you are just, you, like, you can't, the line that he has, which is, like, you can't do this on your own, right? Like, you can't do this alone, which is interesting because, like, you, from the previous couple of episodes, the fact that Philip has kind of gone rogue and told Martha who he is has led to this, like, cascade of issues, right? But there is something in this scene where there's a kind of consolidation that's happening. This is also part of the, like, becoming Philip, but there's also a consolidation happening for Gabriel, in which he's starting to grok that, like, things really are not okay, right? Like, there's something bigger than Philip making these sort of rogue decisions that is going on here, which, like, later on, once he, like, is like, okay, we gotta stop this for you guys. I think that some of that obviously starts with the Martha of it all, but this scene, I think there's a Gabriel consolidation that's happening too.
I like that point, and I think I would add two things onto it. The first is that I suspect that one of the alerts for Gabriel of what's happening is that this is a conversation that he starts with what he thinks is going to be the good news. Like, Misha is back from Afghanistan. He has Arina's mother in Moscow.
Yeah.
Right? And, like, Philip barely, question mark, registers that.
Yeah.
And instead, like, is obsessed, understandably so, about Martha.
Yeah.
Right? But, like, it's the obsessiveness and the total disregard for what Gabriel, like, understands to be procedures. Like, you know, and with Philip then, with Claudia later, he's like, we have procedures for this. We lose agents all of the fucking time. This agent is alive and we got her out. Like, and he doesn't understand, B is doing some back in my day, okay boomer shit, which is not wrong.
Yeah.
But still is some okay boomer shit. And, like, he is having this particular point of consolidation where even with all of the tension he's observed between Elizabeth and Philip, mm-hmm. even with all of the tension between he and especially Philip and occasionally a little bit with Elizabeth, like, he's maintained some idealized version of Philip and Elizabeth as agents, as spies, and the interpersonal relationships there. And it's like the consolidation for Gabriel is that those scales have finally dropped from his eyes.
Yeah, I think that is right. The, like, scales dropping from his eyes feels like a really important piece of this.
I love that scene between the three of them when Elizabeth reveals that she went to Est, and, like, just the shade that is thrown in that room is something else.
It's honestly perfect. And also when Gabriel is like to Claudia later, like, these fucking children, like,
yeah.
But it's interesting, right? Sort of, there's a parallel that happens where Elizabeth, like, lashes out at Philip, and then, or rather, like, Elizabeth is like, Martha's simple, like, everyone relax, like, in a kind of, like, not understanding that then prompts a much more violent or, like, intense form of understanding. And sort of, you see a similar thing happening with Gabriel, which is like, well, these crazy kids, like back in my day, like, we lost an eight, like, I had to kill my best friend from grammar school. It's like, okay, buddy, that should, like, ping that, like, you shouldn't have had to do that. Like, that's a traumatic thing that happened to you. Why are you, like, putting your trauma back on these other people? But then you get the sort of, like, the switch, which is like, you know, okay, something is wrong here. Like, we gotta, like, there's something at work here that, like, needs to be shifted. So, like, both with Elizabeth and with Gabriel, there's a, like, a coming to a head that then prompts a kind of shift.
No notes.
No notes. No notes. A couple of other points, I think, around this, like, becoming Philip. This is a long main discussion. So just quickly, right? Like, before we get to before we move outside of Philip for a bit, the visiting of Jean's grave, first of all, a wild move by Philip because he's wearing exactly the disguise that the FBI has him drawn in.
Yeah, it's like a slightly older Clark with gray hair.
But it's like the glasses are the same shape. Like, come on, man. But I think that visiting Jean's grave is like another reminder that, like, there is something deeper at work than simply, like, having a spy relationship with someone. And I think, like, the thing I was thinking about in the visiting Jean's grave and in all of this happening with Philip in this episode was I was comparing all of this, with, like, the Kimmy stuff, which comes up a little bit here, too.
Yeah.
Where, like, also with Kimmy, like, he was incapable of just, like, being a spy and seducing someone, right? Which is, like, the way that Elizabeth would do it, or mostly the way Elizabeth does it.
Incapable of being seduced, quote-unquote, by Kimmy, who was 15. Like,
right. Well, yeah. And...
Because Kimmy wanted them to fuck.
Kimmy wanted them to fuck, but he was explicitly told by Gabriel, like, you have to do this. And he, like, exactly. would not do it, right? And so, like, yes. there's something about that and about the, like, intensity of the relationship with Martha and the visiting Jean's grave and how much that affected him and has affected him for a long time, right? That, like, it's telling us who Philip is as a result of all these things, and also who Philip is in general, and how that who Philip is so fundamentally different from, like, who Elizabeth is, and that, and maybe even fundamentally, like, different from what it used to be like to be a spy.
Oh, that's an interesting question. Which I maybe want to come back to in later seasons, okay. although the Gabriel stuff, I think, really raises those issues.
Yeah.
The point I'll make is that in an episode where responding to it, you and I have gone to, like, all the different connections between previous things that have seeded all that come to a head in the consolidations of this episode.
Mm-hmm.
This one in particular, like, returns us to the closing scene of season 3,
yeah.
where... he is trying to talk to Elizabeth about how hard of a time that he's yes. having. And Elizabeth is, yeah. like, partially responsive yeah. and then gets distracted by a Reagan speech.
Yes.
Like, this scene is those chickens coming home to roost. Yeah. I'm just going all cliches tonight.
We love cliches. No, I...
Do we?
I mean, I do. Cliches are cliches for a reason.
This is true.
I don't know. I just... Listen, you're talking to someone who I...
Is that itself a cliche?
I think that the, like, lead quote on my dissertation was, like, big girls don't cry, which is also a cliche. So, political theory, cliches abound.
This is true.
I think the last thing, and we've touched on this a little bit, but the last thing is just that, like, all of this with Philip, with the Philip and Elizabeth, Philip, Elizabeth, and Gabriel, like, all of this ends in Gabriel being, like, we gotta, like, too much has come to a head in the last 5 minutes. Like,
too much consolidation.
Exactly. Too much consolidation. You are cut off. And it's interesting that, like, they are being told that they have to, like, dial it back after the pressure has been put on them. And I think really put on Philip. And Gabriel is sort of realizing the what happens when you put all of this pressure on Philip. And, like, I don't have, like, a good counter to this, but it would be interesting and I think different if the pressure had been put on Elizabeth, right? Like, I think the outcome looks different. I don't have a good, like, oh, because in this scene, but it's just, like, again, like, being told that they have to stop, even though it's the, like, Elizabeth coming in and being totally, like, discombobulated after the stuff with Lisa, with the blood on her face and all of that. And, like, you see this, like, moment of real care from Philip. It's, like, I think it's important that all of the pressure has been put on Philip and that is sort of, like, driving the decision that Gabriel makes.
I think it's just that Elizabeth has experienced a different kind of pressure that is less visibly obvious to herself, to Philip, and to Gabriel.
Yeah.
And I think that actually to, like, transition to talking about Paige's consolidations in this episode.
Perfect.
Like, I think that there's something about how much she snaps at Paige and the particular way in which she yeah. snaps at Paige in this episode that highlights to us as audience the pressure that the Paige stuff and the Paige and Pastor Tim stuff has put on
yeah.
not only and primarily Paige, but also on Elizabeth.
Yeah.
Right. And, like, I think that Elizabeth in this, like, moment of everybody and everything is consolidating is like, all right, Paige, you better fucking consolidate right now. And does so, like, in a very, very, very aggressive way.
Yeah, and I agree. And I would also argue that it's like a way that has been needed to be said for a long time, right? And it's like
from her perspective,
from her perspective, but from my perspective too, which is like, there's something that rings true about the, she's like, we have coddled you. And like, this is not an industry that we coddle people in. And you beg to be told, which is like, okay, but you manipulated her into begging to be told, but that's fine. But it's like, we coddled you. We're trying to like, and we didn't kill him, which is like what we are trained to do. And like, if that's going to be what it is, then you're like, you better fucking shape up. And there's a little bit of like get up, sit up in all of that.
There is, and what's like I really recoil against from Elizabeth in this moment, because I'll both end it. Like on some level I agree and like see the virtue and value of that being what she has to do. But on the other hand, like, it's worth remembering that, like, for all that Paige has sought out some of this, like, Paige is 15 years old or whatever she is. And, like, B, that Elizabeth has, as you pointed to, done the manipulating to get Paige into this position.
Yeah.
And then has not only used the fact that she told Pastor Tim as a, like, I am mad at and gonna be compassionate unless you give me reason not to be moment. It's also become part of her arsenal of tools of manipulation. Like, witness the line that at the end of their fight, where it's like, you're all that stands between us and this family being destroyed, which, like, is not wrong, but also, LOL, what?
Yeah.
Are you fucking kidding me?
It's like, also like,
that's nonsense. It's an effective manipulative statement against Paige, I guess, but like that, there's a cruelty or like a form of like emotional violence towards Paige that's happening here.
Yeah.
That like transcends get up, sit up.
No, I agree with that. I'm not saying, like, get up, sit up is, like, the right thing that she should be doing. I just think that, like, the show requires that, like, they stop, like, letting Paige fuck around. And, like, if – and it requires that Elizabeth – and it happens in this moment of, like, you know, anger and passion. But it's a thing that I think needed to happen regardless. And it can only happen between Paige and Elizabeth. It can't happen with Philip around, right? Like,
yeah.
If they're training her to be a spy, then they actually need to do it, right? And, like, they can't just, like, oh, like, you made a mistake and, like,
blah. They can't be, they won't be precious, as Elizabeth tells Paige. Like, you can't be precious about this.
Right. And it's like, I agree with you that these are all, like, manipulation tactics and all that. But, like, at the end of the day, if Paige is going to be a spy, then, like, this is what you have to do. Now, like, Elizabeth has made the decision that Paige is going to be a spy a long time ago and has, like, fucked around with it, right? And sort of, like, let them get off track and whatever. But there's something, I don't know, there's something about the, like, eyes on the prize, like, let's move forward, that, like, I see, it's, like, it is emotionally manipulative for sure. And it has these, like, severe implications for Paige's, like, attitude, mental health, demeanor, right? Her relationship with her parents, which we see later. And yet, like, it is, I think, a consolidation that, like, has needed to happen since episode 2.
That, I would agree with you. And I think that's actually speaks very highly of the show, that both of those readings are extremely available and written and acted and shot and filmed, like, in a, like, really thoughtful manner that keeps all of that, like, circulating.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about the thing that titles the episode.
Before we do that, I have one more point from that Paige discussion.
Oh, it was such a good transition.
That is the, just like some Elizabeth lines, because she's like, you can't control what you feel, but you can control what you do, is like,
I know,
some real theory ship hours from Elizabeth vis-a-vis Danielle and I.
I was laughing because I was like, if we weren't doing Plato season here, this would be like Sarah Achmed all over the place.
Obviously. And then I think my favorite line of the entire episode is just go you're going to go volunteer an extra day for some shit at that goddamn church. Yeah. And I just love that, like, Elizabeth's dancing around being like, oh, we're going to embrace the church and Pastor Tim and all be friends and whatever. Like, just drops that facade and is just like as angry at that church as she possibly can be in that moment. And it's just like volunteer for some shit is a great line.
Agree.
And then obviously that goddamn church is a great line too.
There's just a lot of Elizabeth realness in this episode, and I feel like we haven't been able, like, the last episode we didn't get to have any of that, right? Because she was like coddling Clark or coddling Philip or Philip Clark or whoever it was.
Yeah, sure.
And this episode,
and beating up Martha,
you know, like
casual,
but like this episode it's like fuck Est, fuck you, I loved Gregory. I am stuck with you. And, like, fuck that church. Explicit warning.
Henry gets his own moment of realness to complete your transition that you so kindly started for us. Henry realness is watching David Copperfield, the magician. What the fuck do you think is going on with this David Copperfield stuff in this episode, Danielle?
I mean, I, like, could not have cared less about this David Copperfield thing and absolutely forgot that it was a thing until it came back in at the end. And then I was like, when Henry's like, Dad's not even going to be here. And then Philip's like, I am going to be here. We lost a client. And I was like, oh, is that what you've been telling these people?
That's what we're
calling
you need
it. To sleep over somewhere else because of clients? Like, I'm sorry. Even if you weren't a spy, you're obviously having an affair. So, like, get out of here.
What's the kid's thought, right? Or at least Paige was
that, yeah.
About.
What do you think about... Talk to me a little bit about the David Copperfield consolidation, the connection you see there. Because this is way more your bag than mine.
So I think that... So there's a very surface level reading of this. Like, the obvious thing is that the magicians of the Americans, and we'll get to one reading of that in a little bit, but like the most surface level reading of that is that, like, what do Philip and Elizabeth and the other people in their network, so Gabriel, Claudia, the folks at the Residentura, etc., do? They make people disappear. Now, that can mean getting them on a plane to Cuba, to Prague, to Moscow, or it can mean killing them.
Yeah.
Right? But like, they make people disappear. So there's that surface level reading, like the ultimate consolidation. Death. But there's another, like, consolidation point, which is one of the things that any consolidation, just like thinking very broadly and abstractly about consolidation, is like it filters some things out and makes some things go away and makes some things disappear. And in that sense, like, it is a magic act or a magic trick in the same way that, like, David Copperfield's trick is in this episode, because, like, it's a question of perception and what we're seeing and not seeing. And the things that are consolidated away are, like, not necessarily permanently eliminated, but, like, they're still there and can still act. So in, like, Return of the Repressed fashion or something would be one way to do it. So, like, yes, they're going to, say, just focus on Young Hee and the Kimmy missions, and that's it for a while, and running Paige. But, like, that doesn't prevent all the other shit that Claudia speaks to about the world impinging upon them. So, like, as much as Gabriel and Claudia want to, like, consolidate down for the two of them, like, there's still the, like, what gets filtered out is just in a, like, different realm and kind of relation.
Yeah, I like that. And I think, like, it also, I mean, Martha looms over this episode, even though she's gone, right? And Martha has loomed over Philip's life for a long time, even though she's not physically present in the scenes with Elizabeth, right? So I like that idea of thinking about disappearing, like, consolidation is a kind of disappearing where something might be physically gone, but one's attachment to that thing does not necessarily dissipate. I like that.
Thank you for making my point in a 10 times smarter and more concise way. I really appreciate that.
I'll take it. I mean, I think you made it in a smart way, because I wouldn't have gotten there without your point. So, and I, like, again, forgot that the David Copperfield thing was part of this episode.
Fair. Did you at all see the 7-month time jump coming or anticipate or think about it? Or like, what was your reaction to that one? It's like 7 months later.
I was literally like, we have been in the same 2 weeks for 8 episodes. And all of a sudden now we are like 7 months later. So there's a kind of like, it's like the negative to consolidation, right? Which is like, okay, now we're just going to like, we'll go over here. There's something like off about it, but I was, you know, happy that we could move forward in some way. I was surprised by it though.
Yeah. I mean, it's, and you were talking about this before we started recording and mentioned it just now, the contrast with the, we are deep in like an almost day to day or night to night or night to day, like for the entirety of this first over half of the season, something we kept remarking upon throughout our discussions about it. So like the abruptness of it really really emphasizes how compressed in a good and productive and generative way, the 7¾ episodes up to this point have been. And B, that's, I think the reading is there to say that, like, this is the magic trick that TV can pull off, right? That, like, it can just all of a sudden say, we're 7 months later, and there's a way in which, like, I think this works narratively. It's also very convenient for the show to be able to do this, to, like, move forward in time some to get them, like, further into the 80s. Like, you have, of course, the, like, classic TV problem of you have actors who are teens, so they're growing and changing very rapidly, more so than the show necessarily fits or will allow for. So you can, like, solve for some of that about, like, Heidi Taylor and Kedrick Slotty. And so that's helpful. So, yeah, there's just, like, this is something that's operating on multiple levels and also, like, the meta levels. And this is, like, Fields and Weisberg as the magicians here who, like, institute this time jump.
I like that. I feel like there's been a lot of, we've had a lot of meta in this episode. I think also, like, what it allows us to do as viewers is, like, observe the intensity with which Paige's demeanor and, like, existence has changed as a result of the 7 months prior what happened. We can see it instead of having to experience it every week, which allows us to, like, observe the intensity in a way that would have been more difficult in, like, smaller doses.
I like that point because as effective as, say, like, the reveal episode in Stingers in season 3 through this episode has been about that daily or weekly grind of Paige going through all of this. At some point that would have gotten old or there would have been no more new ground to break or to cover or to get into in a way that like would have stalled the narrative or stalled the show. And you're, I think, precisely pointing out that it's this time jump that allows us to like both see the effects of all of what we just watched, but also be able to engage Paige in a different way.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think like the same holds true for Stan and Gad, who we see at the end.
This is one of the wild choices this make is like, we're going to do a 7 month later time jump. And the central figure in that is Gad, who is retired, like drinking in his like sweater vest at home.
Well,
with Stan.
Gad, who has either been forced to retire or who has been fired.
Oh yeah, forced to retire is I think the
right. So like, but also the thing that it allows. I mean, I agree with you. Like, what a wild place to go. But the thing that it allows us to see is, with some distance, Gad is at least, even if he didn't always see things as clearly as this, he's able to like see and impart some advice to Stan, which like wasn't possible with the closeness. And I wonder like what that sort of like having some distance from something, what the implications of that will be, not just for Stan, but also for Philip and Elizabeth. Like, I wonder if there's some implications for Philip and Elizabeth having some distance from the intensity of their lives over the last, like, few months or years, and then, like, a kind of pause to that. What does it open up for them? That's sort of a question that, like, I have that lingers for me, that even though the Gad Stan stuff is kind of weird, like, it opens that question up for Philip and Elizabeth too.
Yeah, and there's a kind of an epistemological point here about, like, yeah. It's only once he is outside the institution that God can see these things about how that institution and particularly the people within it function, because he has a depth of insight that is unavailable to him throughout the entirety of his time at the FBI and also unavailable to Stan himself. And it's only by, like, going outside of it. And so there's a certain, like, that's a really effective use of the time jump, yeah. Because, like, there's a way in which we are situated similarly to Gad in the, like, distance and time that's created.
Yeah, it's almost like standpoint is a thing. And with that,
I was hoping like Danielle had some smirks, yeah. On her face, and I was hoping that was where we were going.
Like at the minute you said epistemological, I was like, we gotta have a standpoint line here.
Obviously,
I think with that we are done with the main discussion.
There's more to say, but I agree.
We are done with the main discussion.
Yes, correct. All right. How's the dossier doing? It's actually a big L. I want to frame it as a big L for the dossier.
Huge no L. I literally said to John as we started to talk about this episode, I was like, I'm angry. And he was like, okay. And I was like, Martha is still alive. It is an L.
Very alive, like, we think.
Very alive. It is an L. Listen, like, for Philip's sake, I guess I'm like happy that Martha's alive. Because, like, I don't know that he could have handled, like, it wouldn't have been consolidation. It would have been a shattering. so, like, there's that. But, yeah, it's an L. But, you know what? We'll take it because it was elegantly wrapped up, at least for now.
Why are you so frustrated that she's still alive?
I think it just, like, for a long time, narratively, the ratcheting up of the tension around Martha, it just made sense for her to die. Like, it made sense for the tough decision to be, we have to kill her, and not we have to send her to Cuba. Though they've, like, there's tension, they've, like, there's interesting tension around that, too. But, like, the narratively in the show, for a really long time, like, all of these reveals mean that Martha has to die. Like, that just feels like where a spy show goes.
I agree with you. So why do you think that, like, the creators of this show chose to establish a logical endpoint of killing Martha and then do something different and go in a different direction?
I mean,
to Cuba, to Prague, to Moscow.
I think that it's more interesting to do that, right? It keeps things complicated in a way. So I respect the choice, even though it's an L for the dossier.
What future predictions do you have for Martha? Dead?
No, I'm
still maintaining that prediction.
I'm done with Martha dead predictions. Part of me is like, I think we're done with seeing Martha. Although I guess, like, there's a version of, like, in episode 13 of this season where, like, Martha's like playing with a Russian babushka doll or something like that. I don't know. Or like strolling along some river in Moscow or whatever, like learn in a Russian like language class.
Do you want that, like, from the perspective of a viewer of this show? Do you want more Martha, or is, like, this a we don't need more Martha?
No, I don't think we need more Martha. I think, like, Martha, okay, like, functioning as a out of like range, off screen but still present, like, does enough work.
Oh, a present absence? Oh. Is that what you want out of Martha?
It's not that I want. I think that's enough.
All right. I'm like, so we need less some other...
I just, like, I'm less enamored with the Martha character than you are. Other predictions? Oleg,
yes,
and
please.
Tatiana are going to fuck. Like, that's my prediction.
Whether this is true or not, I love this prediction for you.
This is a John-coded prediction.
Why is that?
Because I feel because you're very pro-sex. In, like, the best way possible.
This is one of my deepest schisms with Gen Z, because apparently Gen Z is like, there shouldn't be any sex in movies and TV, and I'm like, more sex in movies and TV.
Well, I know, you fucking love Saltburn. Wait, there was a very funny TikTok that my sister sent me that was like,
please.
It was like a song that was about, it's a song that was about like, do you want to see Barry Keoghan's, like, penis?
Yes.
My answer was no.
This is our fundamental schism.
Exactly. Let's go to Gloss.
Please.
We got a lot in Gloss, so let's be quick with this. All right. I'm okay. The timekeeper of this episode, and I'm doing a bad job.
A little Miss Minutes over there.
Oh, yeah. You know I love Miss Minutes. Okay. So if the theme that got us through the lengthy main discussion was consolidation, I think that, like, the two sort of the two of the remaining things, or the things that are that sort of we want to stick to and gloss from the big plot points, are things that are being unspooled as opposed to consolidated. So I think, like, the Young He scenes are Young He in general as a character is, like, a thread that is still being unspooled. And then I think also Oleg and Tatiana are things that are, is, like, a thing that is being unspooled. Like, this is stuff that we haven't quite yet gotten to the consolidation point. We're still pulling the threads out to see how it unfolds.
I like that framing, particularly because there's a way in which the relationship with Young He is like a zone of total difference in Elizabeth's life than the other parts of it. Is like you and I talked about in the first Young He episode, as you, Lily, and I talked about with regards to friendship in the episode with her in episode 5. So yeah, and like that's a thing that like pulls away from the like carefully knit life that Elizabeth has constructed for herself. Yeah. And so there's a sense in which the like her laughing at the movies with Young He, or then like sneaking in for a classic, like we're going back to see another thing, another movie, but not paying. Like, yeah. There's some genuine like joy, or as close as Elizabeth is capable of feeling to joy in that moment, that I think is just like a totally different dynamic in her life that like really, you know, it sets up, depending on what happens with Young He, like this could be another potential breaking point depending on where this goes, or like a potential source of sustained connection again depending on where it goes. So like that's I think really amazing. And there's this one particular like shot composition of them talking that I have particularly adored in this episode, and again like shouts to Matthew Rhys here, where they've come out of the movies, Young He is looking in a mirror. And so, like, we're getting a little, like, the back of Young He, but we're getting her face in the mirror. But we're also getting just Elizabeth's reflection in the mirror. Yeah. So, like, the real Elizabeth can't actually be present in that space.
Oh, I like
only
that.
Her mirror self. But, like, so there's a meaningfulness to that shot. But it also looks fucking cool because it's the mirror, but there's a neon sign that's attached to the mirror. So there's this pink hue that is thrown on them, on the reflection, on the lighting in the, like, space. And I just, like, it looked really cool and, like, had actual meaning to it. And I love it when that happens.
I love that. I just also, like, I would like to call out your beautiful attention to detail, a thing that I have no eye for, but like the pink hue is like such a, like, it's such a crucial detail because there's a kind of rosiness about her relationship with Young He. Mm-hmm. And like, it's interesting that this is who she calls when the frustration with Philip is starting to bubble, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And also that this is a kind of, this is probably at least in this season, and I think probably since Gregory, the closest she has been with someone in a, I'm going to put in quotation marks, in a real way. Like, it's definitely, and so there's something about the relationship with Young He that is parallel to Philip's relationship with Martha.
Ooh, love that. Look at that attention to detail. I'm not, certainly not the only one who can do that. The other thing that the pink hue does, in addition to, like, the rosiness of that relationship for Elizabeth, is there's a certain different embodiment of femininity that Elizabeth is doing when she is Patty with Young He, like around Mary Kay, around the cosmetics, around all of that stuff that I think is like implicated there as well.
Love it. Let's go to Oleg and Tatiana. Tatiana is like a little bit down in the dumps. Oleg is like, what's up, babe? Hey, you up?
I mean, he would, or like, season one, Oleg would say that. Season four, Oleg is like new masculinity of the Soviet 80s.
Oh my God.
Well, like, this scene is cool because there's a certain kind of emotionality that, like, Verna Cherny as Tatiana finally gets to play, because Tatiana is a very, like, buttoned up, like, character who is, like, logos coded, I think, throughout the, like, throughout season three and four. And so to, like, add some emotional depth to her character is, I think, a nice touch here. And to do so in this moment with Oleg, where she, like, is safe divulging some of that emotionality to Oleg, but then is like hesitant maybe in general, but then specifically about talking about it to Oleg, because Oleg's like just lost his brother in Afghanistan, and she says, well, you're the last person I should be talking about this to, like, given what happened to your brother, right? And then, like, Oleg silently, if I remember correctly, just like holds out in his hand and like holds her hand. It's like, it's another like, so there's a tiny, 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 like, this is the pivot off of the wordless opening scene, is, like, here's a moment of genuine connection expressed in a wordless scene between two people, or wordless moment in a scene between two people.
I love that. I still want to read this scene as, like, we're inching towards fucking.
Extremely not mutually exclusive.
Extremely not. Okay, Claudia, back.
Claudia back. We love Claudia.
Claudia's just, like, hanging out at Gabriel's. Her, I mean, they're each other's, like, not side pieces, but, like, like,
friends with benefits?
She's just, like, there. And like, Philip and Elizabeth don't know that she's, there's something about her just, like, being in his house. It's like, okay.
It's such a cool scene because we get a different version of Gabriel. Like, he gets to express frustration to her, and in a way that he doesn't feel able to Philip and Elizabeth. Mm-hmm. And much like he doesn't put up with the bullshit, what he perceives as bullshit from Philip and Elizabeth, and oftentimes is, Claudia has, like, zero room for anything that Gabriel is spewing here. Even as Gabriel is like, this was an intense tragedy when I was 20 years old, where I had to send my friend to his execution in front of his,
wild,
like, wife and kids. And Claudia is like, Claudia is the ultimate get up, sit up.
Oh, 1,000,000%.
Is what I'm trying to say.
A million. Fully endorse that read of Claudia. We've got another throwback in this episode. We've got Claudia back. We've got Misha back. But also,
you're right, Danielle. We also have not Kimmy herself, Julia Garner, unavailable, apparently. But the Kimmy tapes still exist. Isaac Breland from the CIA Afghan group still getting spied on. Philip still apparently once a month or once a week or whatever going to Kimmy's house to hang out and smoke weed and recover the tapes.
Another thing I forgot about. Like, it's like this episode, there are all of these things that are back, which is kind of wild.
Can I add something else that I think is back?
Yeah.
And again, this is a great temporality episode because, like, there's the past, the present, the future with the time jump. There's a way in which, like, Nina is haunting this episode as well, because there's the Est scene about, like, what does freedom mean? Do people actually want to be free? And you and I have established that, like, the best philosopher in the Americans is
Nina.
So.
Agreed.
Like, Nina, like, she would, like, totally trash Est guys, like, bullshit, quote-unquote philosophizing, but, like, she can't because RIP, pour one out for the real one, Nina, but, like, she has a lot to say about freedom, and including freedom in confinement.
Pour one out. Another thing that's back in this episode is we get another mention of Epcot. Maybe they're finally going to Epcot. I literally laughed out loud when this came up in the episode. Elizabeth going to Est and then the Epcot mention, I was like, come the fuck on, everyone. But I loved it.
I stay the Epcot jokes. And I stay my Epcot theory, Epcot theory just keeps getting proven over and over again, because it's like, at this moment where there's the fantasy of being as close to a vacation as they could possibly have, what do they talk about? They talk about Epcot, the imaginary cosmopolitan utopia that doesn't actually exist because of power, but yet it's a wonderful empty signifier for their false ideological hopes and dreams.
You're welcome, everyone, for John's re-upping of his Epcot galaxy brain theory.
I love it. I love it. I also love, and this is another, like, so episode 4.3 just came out earlier today, or yesterday. I should say. And the other point, more important point than Epcot that we talked about in that episode, is that spying is an MLM. And here we have great Marxist Elizabeth moment revealing EST as itself a fucking capitalist ploy MLM itself on its own terms.
I've never identified more with Elizabeth in my life than when she was like, all of this is just to manipulate you. And he's like, are you saying,
take your money.
Are you saying that I'm being manipulated? And she's like,
I'm not saying that.
And also, like, how the fuck do you not see it? Which I appreciated. I was like, exactly. Also, it can be an MLM and manipulating you and also be working for you, right? Like, that all of those things exactly. are not mutually exclusive, which is like
what Young-hee identifies to Elizabeth earlier in the episode.
Exactly. And it's also, that's the, like, the thing with Philip is, like, he's trying to have these hard lines around what it means to be American and what it means to be a Russian. And, like, he's struggling between those things, right? And Elizabeth's like, I'm Russian, and, like, and some of this stuff also still makes sense to me, and that's fine.
Right. I want to throw out a note to, like, I don't think we've actually remarked upon this.
Oh,
what is serial killer handwriting on the chalkboards at S?
Wait.
Like, holy shit, who writes on a chalkboard like that?
I had this in my notes, and I was like, okay, somebody literally, like, pasted up signs on these chalkboards
exactly.
because this is, like, when I was in elementary school, the chalkboard, one of the chalkboards had, like, the handwriting lines on them. And this is, like, somebody wrote in those fucking lines and then unpeeled the lines off. It is sociopathic. I have it in my notes. I forgot to put it on the outline. I'm so glad that you did. It was crazy.
Agreed.
No notes.
A few random smaller est moments. Male robot back. Sadly, we do not get to see our hero, male robot. But we do get to hear male robot, our king or queen or non-binary ruler.
Non-binary ruler, I think.
Sovereign. Sovereign of our lives.
There's a lot of, like robotic technology gendering happening in this episode for us, and I don't love it.
I don't love it either.
Other random smaller stuff.
Also not loving it, producer Amy, considering Amy and I wrote, I would like to say, the definitive piece on gendering Alexa and AI, domestic AI robots.
Agree. Although I do love, my parents have an Alexa, and it's very easy to just make it play Harry Styles all the time when we're in the kitchen, which is where it hangs, which is where it lives and where we all hang out.
Yeah. Yeah. Emily has a Google Home device, and, like, so I've had to figure out how to incorporate that into my life.
I see. You can tell it to play music. That's the most useful thing.
I'm aware.
Timers
while cooking and music seem to be the two most useful.
This is what we use it
situations.
For also.
And, like, I also, like, literally, producer, I mean, I wrote the article of, like, why I feel icky still doing it. Anyway. Fashion corner quick check. Elizabeth's brown jacket in this episode is fire. I love it so much. And Gabriel's outerwear continues to be undefeated.
Agree. Fully agree. He looks like a gentleman.
Sure.
Like a respectful man on the street. He's got a cane now. It, like, completes the look. Okay. Borrowed
Great.
Nostalgia for the unremembered 80s. Nope. You kick
Boring
us off
20s.
Because these are song cues that I did not know.
Okay, there's one that I also did not know, but in the continued run of the Americans really nailing the 80s music, and, like, this particular era of 80s music in a really wonderful way. Of course, there's a Roxy Music song. Here, they have the Roxy Music song, End of the Line, for the end of the episode with Paige and extremely pregnant Alice and Pastor Tim. for the scenes of Hockey in the driveway with Henry, who's finally getting parented and has being spent with, and then the Gavin scenes. Roxy Music, more like 80s electropop brilliance and more 80s electropop brilliance on The Americans. There's also the song that's playing while Philip and Gabriel are in the bar, which the internet tells us is Lloyd Conger, I Like Your Kind of Love.
Love. I feel like the next, to keep on the media theme, the movies. So they go, Elizabeth and Younghee go see Tender Mercies, and then they sneak into The Outsiders, which both feel very 80s.
I have no idea what Tender Mercies is.
It's like an 80s. This is not like anything that the episode doesn't give us, like tearjerker or whatever, if I'm remembering it correctly. The Outsiders to me is like quintessential 80s because it was something that came out. Sure. It must have come out around when I was born or maybe like a little bit before. But
yeah, because we're in 83. We're in like spring, summer of 83.
So. Yeah. And so like The Outsiders was something that was like always on TV. When I was growing up, it was like always on Channel 11 on a Saturday, you know, it was like something like that. But I would also say that the movie theater aesthetic is like the popcorn boxes, the soda, the garbages, like even just the carpet, like movie theaters don't look like that anymore.
Unless, Danielle, the relevant comparison point is the theater in Worcester, Mass, where you and I saw Mission Impossible. Oh, yeah. Dead Reckoning, plus 25 other words in the title.
Listen, the theater...
It had a wonderful time.
The theater that is...
With the dads.
With all the dads. The theater that has been lost to time. It's like the only theater in America that still has, like, bucket seats, but that, like, don't go back, but they just, like, you're sort of sitting, like, your butt is, like, somehow on the
weird
floor.
Weird angle. Yeah, strange.
And I have, like, little legs, which my sisters, I was just home, and my sisters, like, drove my car, and they were like, you literally have your chin on the steering wheel. I'm like, I have little legs. They're like, we're all the same height. Caitlin is the shortest of all of us. She's 5'2", and she's like, you, like, sit too close to the steering wheel for me, and I'm, like, 4 inches shorter than you. Like, my legs are little.
Danielle, did you have moments in your life where you did the double feature for the price of one move? I definitely had. There was one summer, I want to say the summer like in between junior and senior year of high school, where one of my friends and I did that all the fucking time.
No, mostly because like I, you know, we were like...
United Artists, Park Meadows 12, Lone Tree, Colorado, what's up? I saw so many movies without paying that summer.
No, one, because I'm just like a rule follower, and two, because usually we would like go, if I was going to the movies, it would be like after swim practice, and so it would only be one movie, and then we would probably have to get up the next morning for swim practice, so it's like, if it's not part of the plan, I'm not into it.
Love it. What else do we have in the 80s? We have just like Philip on the couch reading an Est book seems extremely 80s to me. Like I know that there's in particular, I would say like the last like 5 years or so, like a certain kind of attempts at edgy self-help that have become more popular again, including like books.
Yeah.
One or two of which may exist on my bookshelf and I may have read recently, which Danielle, like
sometimes you,
Danielle, I had
sometimes you read to me.
True. Yeah, that's right. We have talked about that, about one book in particular in both of our lives. But anyway, like there's just something about reading an Est book in the 80s on the couch in a like, hardback that's felt very 80s.
Fully agree. I would also say that just like David Copperfield, the magician, feels very 80s. Like, and a televised magician special feels like an 80s thing. Like,
80s, 90s, yeah. It's viable in both eras.
Yeah, it's like that and like Elvira's Halloween special are like...
What a pull. Listen. I love it.
Nothing without nostalgia. Also, the Miller High Life six-pack bottles. Yeah. There's something about the like clear, like cylindrical bottle that's like all one shape.
It's too wide at the top. It doesn't taper,
but it's also like there is something about that that gives me nostalgia for like 80s, early 90s barbecues at my grandparents' summer house on Shelter Island that, like, all these, like, big family things and, like, beer bottles that look like that.
Yeah. Champagne and beers. We love it. We didn't get a chance to talk about that scene in the main discussion. It's just a really funny scene between Stan and Phillip.
Like,
Stan just comes over. He's like, I'm out of beer. So he goes straight to the fridge, cracks open, chugs almost the entire beer immediately upon cracking it open. So we stand that, so to speak. And then he just walks off with the rest of the six-pack.
When he left with the six-pack?
Does not stay for dinner, just walks off with the six-pack and pieces the fuck out.
Coming
there.
To your neighbors to be like, I need a beer is like a totally fine thing.
I'm out of beer. Yeah.
Right. And like, but again, like, oh, I have no beer. I'm out of beer. I need a beer.
I need to talk. I need some bro time. Yeah.
Coming to your neighbors, having an emotionally stunted conversation and including a big work reveal that you definitely shouldn't be talking about to anybody, let alone the KGB spy that you've been looking for.
Sure. Correct.
But then making off with his full six pack of beer is a wild move.
It's just rugged individualism at work.
Ugh. Wild. Totally wild. What else closes out here?
Phillip's outfit when he goes to Jean's grave, I feel like, is a slightly, we talked about, like, it's one tick off from the Clark get up, but it's like fuddy-duddy, like, I own a bookstore in suburban Virginia, but it's the 80s.
Yeah, no notes.
Hours for,
no notes.
For our boy, Phillip. All right, let's go to minor character of the week. Our minor character of the week this week, Danielle, is the pilot who offers no words, is just part of these silent scenes. And unfortunately, IMDb is silent about the actor playing this pilot. So we would like to give shouts to the pilot who is flying their plane from the middle of the cornfield to Cuba. Clearly, like, has done this before. This is Tatiana's pilot.
Yeah.
Clearly, like, is cool just being like, here's a bag. I'm not going to ask what's in this bag.
You don't need to show me that dead rat.
Deadly bioweapon rat.
Not a bioweapon.
And here's this person I'm taking. Right, of course. We did have to get that in there.
Obviously. So, we also, because the pilot is not, you know, not listed on IMDb, I nominated a backup minor character of the week, which is Clark. R.I.P. Clark. It's the death of Clark.
For our boy.
He's really gone now. No longer a minor character. Peace out.
No longer a character.
No longer a character.
Except in Phillip's broken fucking psyche.
Oh, sad.
Sad. Sad boy.
We have gotten ourselves to the cave.
Plato season.
Yes. We got a new text for us today.
Yeah. Danielle is having us do the Euthyphro. I say that not out of spite, but out of ignorance, because, like, I don't fucking know anything about the Euthyphro. So, nonetheless, I am scrolling, Danielle. You tell me when to stop, and we'll Euthyphro it up.
All right, stop.
Okay, can you give me a letter?
Let's go with D for Danielle.
D for Danielle. All right, so Danielle, we're talking about piety, it would appear.
Ugh.
So here is Socrates and Euthyphro. Socrates, what then do we say about the pious, Euthyphro? Surely that it is being loved by all the gods, according to what you say. Euthyphro, yes. Socrates, is it being loved because it is pious or for some other reason? Euthyphro, for no other reason. Socrates, is it being loved then because it is pious, but it is not pious because it is being loved. Euthyphro, apparently. Socrates, and yet it is something loved and God-loved because it is being loved by the gods. Euthyphro, of course. Socrates, then the God-loved is not the same as the pious, Euthyphro, nor the pious the same as the God-loved, as you say it is, but one differs from the other. How so, Socrates? Socrates, because we agree that the pious is being loved for this reason, that it is pious, but it is not pious because it is being loved.
I'm going to reveal something here. I hate this dialogue so much.
Why is that?
Well, part of it is because this is, I mean, I think this dialogue, which is like one of the earlier Socratic dialogues, right? So usually this is, it's basically like this, the apology, the Crito, and the Phaedo, and oftentimes those get kind of smushed together.
Sure. And I should say we are in 10D through E, what I just read.
I know. This is like the big quote from, it's like the, is it pious because it is loved by the gods, or is it pious for some other reason? And that is the reason the gods love it, right? Like that's the question. Yeah. And the mm-hmm. question of this dialogue mm-hmm. is like, what is piety? What does it mean to be pious? Yeah. What is piety? What's the value of piousness? And this mm-hmm. question comes about because like, I think that it's like a brother kills his brother, and so there's like a, or like a father kills a son, it's like some familial thing, and so the question of like, you know, the, and these are relationships that are not supposed to be violated, right? And so like, what is the reason sure. why they're not supposed to be violated? And so, but I think like this question of piety and this question of, and the sort of debate around defining something like piety, which is this like heavy, heady concept, to me feels like it's connected to this episode for a number of reasons. I think there's like one way to unspool it where like we go in the Paige, Pastor Tim religion direction.
I'm going to venture a guess and say that's not the direction you yourself, Danielle Hanley, would like to go.
That is correct. But I also think that there, like, the, we might think about, like, piety as the thing upon which Philip and Elizabeth differ on, right? Which is, like, that the level of, like, devotion that they have and the reason for their devotion to the cause is different for both of them. And I think like one of the things we're seeing start to, we've been seeing this start to crack over a number of, like over the entire run of the Americans till now. But something I think that comes to a head in this episode is like, what is the reason why we're here? What is the reason why we do this? And what is the reason why we're together? Is it just that we're being told we're supposed to be together? Or is there something else there? And I think like that question has a similar structure to it that as to the like, is it pious because it's loved by the gods? Or is it loved by the gods because it's pious? Right? Like that, like, there's not really an answer. It's not necessarily an answerable question. And this is like one of the Socratic dialogues where aporia, right, the sort of like raising of unanswered questions is like quite famous. And I think that that is kind of an unanswered question in the Americans.
Okay. A, brilliant. B, partial shared brain. I would not have been able to get quite as far, although I was going to start along the same track, but my train like went off and the rails much sooner than yours just kept going. But I think I love the setting it up about like devotion to the cause and turning it back to like, what is the reason that they're together? Yeah. And like, where is the source of the piety for one another or piety for their relationship? And what is the role of love? And what is the source of the reason that they're all together? Mm-hmm. I really love that. And so I would just slightly frame or keep pushing the like devotion to the cause point, because I think that one of the questions that separates Philip and Elizabeth, and you were hinting at this, I believe, is that like they are devoted to the cause or devoted to the Soviet Union or are active, violent agents of the Soviet Union, like for extremely different reasons. Like there is a piety in the, there is some good independent of this is what the nation wants.
Yeah.
This is like the God's love for Elizabeth that is not there for Philip. Even though for Elizabeth, part of the reason that like there is the devotion or the piety to the cause is just because the gods love it, i.e. because the Soviet state ideology system, society, et cetera, like loves it and dictates it as such. That's the, I would just like take yours and keep going, like circle back to the original devotion to the cause point a little bit.
Yeah, more. No, I love that. I love that. I think part of the reason why I love Plato season is I just like love being in these texts. Even the ones I don't like.
I know you do. Even the ones you hate, your most hated dialogue.
Ugh, I hate this one. I don't teach it because it's like unnecessarily annoying.
I read this literally my first quarter of undergrad and probably have not read it since.
I will say that it does make, and then we can go to theory ship, but it does make some of the questions that arise in Antigone, it underlines them, right? Because this question of filial piety is also a way into the question of justice in Antigone, which then like is also a good connection to the question of justice raised in Apology and Crito.
Danielle's so smart. She's such a good political theorist.
She's just really good at the ancients. But not, I mean, like, I'm saying that, but, like, plenty of people wouldn't say it.
Well, you know what I say? Fuck those people.
Exactly. Let's do some theory ships to close it out.
Those people could not theory ship. They could not go, they are not allowed into the cave.
No, although I will say that our theory ships this week are, like, so conventional.
That's right. I came up with another one that I'm gonna try to be slightly less conventional.
I love a surprise theory ship. Okay, so my theory ship is, and part of this, we touched on it, or you touched on it a little bit with regard to Nina. We haven't really talked about, like, all the places where they talk about freedom in this episode.
Yeah.
So my theory ship is, I'm going to give Elizabeth, Philip, and the Est dude, like...
Fuck that guy. And David Copperfield.
And David Copperfield. A little bit of Rousseau. In particular, that first banger of a line, man is born free, but everywhere he's in chains. I think, like, that's kind of an interesting, not necessarily counter, but an interesting, it complicates the, like, discourses on freedom that keep popping up in this episode in some interesting ways.
I love that because, you know, the Est guy is doing this whole, like, you don't actually want to be free. You love your change. You love your imprisonment or whatever, like psychic, emotional, actual, spiritual, whatever the fuck he means. And I think Rousseau is, like, the perfect person in the canon to pair with that particular point. Because, like, Rousseau is also skeptical of how genuinely humans really desire freedom in the sense that he thought they had before, like, the invention of property, the invention of society, the invention of language even, like, all this kind of stuff.
Yeah, and, like, for him, it's like, you can never go back, and yet there's a kind of nostalgia for the going back.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And so he's always...
Which Marx also has, for the record, so...
Well, and, like, Marx was a great reader of Rousseau.
Exactly. Yeah.
Who are you theory shipping?
So I want to take this, like, question of friendship or companionship, because that's, like, a something that Danielle and I have touched on several points in this episode, and think about, like, philosophy and friendship, politics and friendship. And so I'm gonna give different friendships to different character pairings. All right. So, like, we're going to go old school and we're going to throw the Nicomachean Ethics. We're going to give that to Philip and Stan. Because, like, they're both dudes, so Aristotle thinks they, like, can, you know, can get past the oikos. Good for them. And so, like, they can engage in friendship and political friendship in the way that that Aristotle would like them to. And, like, maybe they can engage in philosophy. They can do virtue. They can do abstract thought together. Except that they can't actually be pals because they are working for the FBI and the KGB against one another. So, whatever. We're still giving them Aristotle. Then I want to give Deleuze and Guattari What is Philosophy, where they turn to, like, questions about friendship, philosophy, and politics. And we're going to give that to Elizabeth and Young Heath because they're going to have a much more exciting reading group than Stan and Philip are going to have. And then my less conventional one is we're going to give Sybil Schwarzenbach's book on civic friendship, which is a cool reading, cool, like, feminist philosophy reading of Aristotle and Marx, among others, on the question of civic friendship. And we're going to give that to Tatiana and Oleg, because I think like, they would appreciate it maybe more than any other character pairing or potential companion. So those are my respective theory ships on the topic of, like, civic and philosophical friendship.
In love, love, love the pairing of the conventional with the unconventional. No notes.
Trying to do my part.
No notes.
Trying to do my part.
We have somehow come to the end of this episode.
Shocker.
Shocker.
Under 2 hours. I thought we were headed for a 2 hour plus.
Same.
Danielle was not going to let it happen.
No, I start to get antsy when we get over an hour in the main discussion. And then I'm like, we got to move it along.
There was a version of this episode where Gloss was 40 minutes long, and you kept us away from that path.
I just can't. At that point...
And I commend you for it.
I just can't, like... Once we've been in the main discussion for so long, I'm like, I gotta get to the fun stuff.
I feel
No, it's not a you thing. It's like the main discussion, especially for this episode, was like heavy, right? Like there's, yes, it's like, it's like very intense. And so I was like, we can't, like, I can't dig in more. We gotta get to the silly stuff.
Agreed.
Thanks as always to producer Amy. Buy her book, The Price of Humanity. You can get it now at all of your favorite.
You've been able to get it for months. Go to bookshop.org, though, or your local bookstore.
Exactly. Favorite bookstore. Up next, in 2 weeks in the feed, Americans, season 4, episode 9, The Day After. The Day After Tomorrow. The Day After Paige Freaks Out. The Day After Tom Cruise is in a disaster movie. Like, I don't know, but it's called The Day After, and, like,
We'll find out. Danielle will find out. I know what it's about.
I'll find out.
Do you want a teaser about something that happens that's very exciting in the next episode, or do you want to go in
cold? No, I want to go in cold.
Okay.
I can't wait to text you about whatever this is, though.
Oh, you're gonna know within 0.1 second of the thing happening. You're gonna text me and be like, I know exactly what you were talking about. I'm really excited that this happened.
Oh my God, I want it to be Martha dying.
There's a plane crash in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. They've never made it to Prague.
Well, that's it from us. Thanks so much for joining us on another episode of Not Quite Great Books,
a TV podcast. Thank you for joining us on another episode of Not Quite Great Books, a TV podcast. It's created by Daniel Hanley and John McMahon, and indirectly, producer Amy. You can find us on Twitter at NotGreatBooksTV. You can email us at NotGreatBooksTV@gmail.com. If you have comments or questions that we might potentially read and respond to on air, subscribe, download, rate, review us, tell your friends to find us at Apple Podcasts, Podbean, Spotify, and Amazon Music, and Google Podcasts. We would like to thank Less FM for Electro Trend 60, which is the music that you heard at the beginning and you are hearing right now. Until next time, go play some racquetball.